Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn how eating red grapes can help fight off cancer. Pennsylvania State University has an important study there. I'll go into it in some depth because I believe we have to start preventing disease, be more conscious of what we can have within our power. Also today, anti-inflammatory effects of taking curcumin. This is a systematic review and meta-analysis, meaning looking at a lot of randomized controlled trials to see what's the outcome. Newcastle University, which is in the United Kingdom. Also, the Mediterranean diet, another study showing it improves erectile dysfunction. So we'll deal with that. And people often avoid feeling compassion for others. Why? Well, they feel it's a lot of effort. Penn State University. Okay, we'll challenge that. And then greater dietary intake of tocotrienols and tocopherols, which are vitamin E, are associated with a low risk of disabling dementia. And this is from the University College London, as well as the Tohoku University in Japan. Also, eating protein 3 times a day could make our seniors stronger. McGill University Health Center in Montreal. And suicide risk is linked to the push for perfection. What's that mean? I'll explain what it means when your potential in life is based upon, am I good enough where I'm at, or must I always be better? And what if I can never achieve that which I consider important enough to feel good about all of my efforts? University of Western Ontario. Those are some of the issues we're addressing. Also today, I want to do a couple classrooms on the air. I have a guest, Dr. Michael Hudson. Professor Hudson will be on. What has the Democratic Party really become in renewing the nation with all of its stimulus packages? He is one of the most honest, intelligent, and highly respected economists in the world. And he will be here to unpackage that concept. And I'll be opening it up for those of you who have questions as he appears. Also, we're going to have on 2 experts. Now, these are really good physicians, and both are scientists, MD, PhD, Dr. Ryan Cole and Dr. Peter McCullough, because we want you to see what you can understand about COVID that can help save your life. Practical information, and it's good information. We'll deal with that also today. And I will always try to set time aside for you to call in and share your points of view. And just by the way, I'm curious to see how many people in the audience, we can only take a couple calls because my show's packed today. But if you've had multiple sclerosis, a disease that medicine cannot stop, at best, they can slow it down, sometimes put it for a short period of time in remission, but it's irreversible, who've actually reversed it using my protocols. Call 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Now, 3 weeks ago, when I asked people who had end-stage or terminal cancer to call in, we had so many calls that I could only get about 3 of them on. But these were all people who today who have no cancer, who had terminal cancer, and use the protocols. So I'd like to see what about multiple sclerosis. I'll do other diseases on upcoming programs. Now we go to eating grapes. Now, grapes are really good for a lot of reasons, and hopefully organic grapes. But according to this study by researchers at Pennsylvania State University, what we call Penn State, the combination of resveratrol, resveratrol, 3 syllables, from the skin of red grapes, that's where you're getting the phenolic compounds, it's actually in the skin. Also, if you've got grape seeds, which very few people eat seeds with in grapes today, they all want seedless, you can actually stop the development of tumors and even kill colon cancer stem cells, the progenitor cells, the mother cell, because you see, you can debulk a tumor, you can use chemotherapy, radiation on a tumor, and initially it looks like you've killed it, but then it can grow back if you didn't get the stem cell. So these immortal cells are known as the seeds of cancer because of their unlimited capacity to self-renew and proliferate and their role in tumor formation. And at present, there are no mainstream drugs that can kill cancer stem cells. Now, that's not the same as killing cancer cells, which a lot of drugs successfully kill cancer cells. And by the way, we're in the process, along with Robert Houston, one of America's leading investigative journalists. Robert and I did an article together going way back, 1971, on the politics of cancer, the first ever in a national magazine. It won the Audi Award for Best Investigative Journalism, but nobody would touch it. No liberal publication that I would publish with. As one of the leading liberals at the time in journalism, not Mother Jones, not Ms. Magazine, not none of these. In fact, the one of the magazine's managing editors said, "Your story is true. We'd love to publish it. We'd lose all of our advertising." So that's the reality. But in any case, we did a lot. And one of the things that we noticed is we don't distinguish between the effort at curing a cancer or heart disease or any other condition versus the results. And now we're fully committed to effort funding, effort ideology, effort propagandizing, effort politics, but without looking, what was the outcome of your effort? Well, if we did that, then probably 90% of all cancer efforts would be stopped because the results are not positive. So we're doing this. We're making a chart only using peer-reviewed literature showing which cancer therapies, orthodox therapies, work and which don't. That'll help. And then which alternative therapies work and which don't, and that'll help also. In any case, we're dealing with resveratrol. It's a botanical compound that can be found in a lot of berries. You can find them in blueberries, bilberries, and cranberries. But it's strongly associated with red grapes and red wine, and that's kind of a myth. The amount of resveratrol, and I did this analysis in the laboratory. I just wanted to see. I took a pound of grapes and tried to synthesize the amount of resveratrol versus a bottle of wine. You'd have to drink a case of wine to get what I believe is a therapeutic dose of resveratrol. Yes, there's red wine in there. But also, when they started saying, well, people in these Mediterranean countries who drink red wine, which they do at almost every meal, they have less heart disease, less cancer. It's not because of the red wine. Also, those wines that are homemade, and most are, and shared. I was in one, just a school teacher's house in France, near the Alps, and he had 27,000 bottles of wine he had made himself over his lifetime. But he didn't have sulfates in them, and sulfates are extremely dangerous to your lungs, and very low alcohol content, just tiny alcohol content. So understand you have to look at everything else. Oh, you mean the fact that the family unit is very important, that you have people you can speak with and laugh with and argue with and still love you? That has nothing to do with it. No, it's just the wine. Okay. The fact that they take their time eating and they eat a lot of organic food and they grow a lot of food and they enjoy their food and that siesta after the meal, that meal isn't rushed. It could take an hour to 2 hours. I've sat in Italian villagers' homes where I worked out that morning in the fields with them because I'm also an organic, certified organic farmer, and I teach farming. I teach agriculture and horticulture. I teach the botany of the plant and have for 50 years, and I've taught that to tens of thousands of people. So when I'm in any environment, I have a lot I can share with the farmer. They just think, oh, you're America? Yeah, watch us work. No, I'm going to jump in there and work. And therefore, when you're sitting at that table and you see everything's brought out one thing at a time, and they talk and they deal with all the issues, different generations, and you're telling me that has nothing to do with state of mind, state of consciousness, value of something to live for, not afraid of dying, but fully embracing living in the day they're in, that is unimportant. It's just that glass of wine. No, that is called monotheism. That is what science has become. I spent the morning editing a new film on the politics of science. The first rough cut is done. I look forward to premiering this, and this will be the most scorching documentary ever presented about what's wrong in the world today in medicine and science. And boy, we do not look at the bigger picture. We do not look beyond specializations. We do not look upon the single magic drug, or we do not take into account the power of positive thinking or the power of negative thinking. Healthy choices, bad choices. What happens when there are a lot of other people giving you input on your choices? They may be right or wrong, but what would you do differently, and what would you have done differently if you had had loving people give you some input that you could weigh against the decisions you were making? Would you have made the same decisions? Possibly yes, possibly no. But you've got to look at the totality of something, the guy, the whole complex picture, not just something superciliously simple because someone has been conditioned that that's all you need. No, when you're looking at a diet that is so diverse, that has so many nuts and seeds and beans and grains and legumes, and they're almost always whole, when you can walk into a kitchen and see 30 different types of olives and olive oil that they're going to be using, and dried and pickled vegetables fermenting for probiotics, and they've done this for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, passing down great recipes, and now we think, ah, that's rich in probiotics. Ah, yeah. That's why you have to take the time to look deeper and slower. So I'm saying that grapes are good. They're really good. But I would always select the grapes, eating them or grape juice, over a glass of red wine. So aside from resveratrol, you need to understand that these are called flavonoids. Flavon, F-L-A-V-O-N, oids, O-I-D-S, and also what are called still beans, S-T-I-L-B-E-N-E-S. They also are abundant in high-promoting phytonutrients. So what do we know now? It can lower blood pressure. It can improve blood circulation. It can protect healthy cells from oxidative damage. It can help microbial infections and reduce cancer risks. That's just some of what it can do. But back to cancer. In this study at Penn State, researchers found that a high concentration of resveratrol can increase the effectiveness of grapeseed extract against colon cancer cells. This led them to hypothesize that this combo could also work against cancer stem cells, which are responsible for the resistance shown by certain tumors to chemotherapy and radiation. To their knowledge, no other study had tested the potency of these combinations against colorectal cancer stem cells. And so they use cultured human colon cancer stem cells and then use resveratrol and grapeseed extract. And they also use mice with chemically induced colon cancer to see if the combination could prevent tumor formation under biological conditions. And the researchers found that the resveratrol grapeseed extract combo suppressed the growth of tumors in the mice without causing any stomach issues. They also found that the grape compounds managed to reduce the number of colon, what are called crypts containing cancer stem cells, by causing the stem cells to commit suicide, what is called an apoptosis. Now, meanwhile, people are not being aware of this, and this is important. Prevent a disease is a lot better than trying to treat it afterwards. Also, from Newcastle University, according to the latest study, chronic inflammation is the major contributing factor to the development of non-communicable diseases. And what's the solution? Curcumin. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. That's the bioactive polyphenol from turmeric, and it's a well-known anti-inflammatory agent. There are thousands upon thousands of studies on PubMed about curcumin. So that's what they found. It really turns off inflammation in the body, and that's what you want. Overall, everywhere in the body, in your joints, in your muscles, fibromyalgia, in your back, lower back pain, around your heart, in your lungs. And finally, The latest research from the European Society of Cardiology shows that men with high blood pressure frequently suffer from erectile dysfunction, and erectile dysfunction often coexist in hyperactive aging men, aging over the age of 40, by the way. And what they found was that going on a healthy plant-based diet is one of the best ways. Why? What would be the cause there? Here's what's interesting. They don't get it in here. Yes, they do say more vegetables and fruits and whole grains and legumes and fish, olive oil can make a big difference. But what are you getting? Nitric oxide. Like when you have beets and beet juice and rhubarb and pomegranate, nitric oxide opens up the blood vessels. Blood vessels open, boom, more blood. More blood, that helps. And that helps overcome erectile dysfunction. I'm going to stop now because I'm going a long way in the program. And tomorrow I'll deal with this interesting study about compassion, because compassion helps us relate to and feel the sympathy of others. My compassion towards animal, because I've had an animal sanctuary. I've rescued and found homes, living homes for life, for over 5,000 sentient creatures, giraffes and almost every kind of animal you can think, except not wild cats, but feral cats. Yes, get them neutered, get rid of their existing diseases, which takes about 2 or 3 months, and now they're just as playful and wonderful, and they're around the barn, and they're healthy as can be. And we don't have a rodent problem because of the rats, knowing that those feral cats out there are not going to be inviting him to dinner. Anyhow, so I'm always supportive of people who take in a dog, take in a cat. Of course, ideally take in a human who needs help after knowing more about the human so you don't end up having a problem. And we should always make room in our life for those who don't have anywhere else to have a room in their life. So tomorrow I'm going to deal with this whole idea that why aren't we being more open and compassionate, especially the people who could certainly afford it, like Oprah and Beyonce. They have so much money. They don't have to take people into their own homes. They could take a whole city block and convert it with clinics to help people with their health problems, emotional and physical, using natural protocols, rehabilitate all the buildings so people are living in nice, energy-efficient apartments, depending upon what they need, a single person versus a family, and having a food co-op that the people can work in, and then have all the wonderful foods. There's so much they could do, and I don't see them doing diddly squat. I'm not trying to shame them. I'm not into that. I'm just saying, imagine if everyone who had a break gave a break. That's all. Tomorrow I'm going to deal with that, of why we feel it's just too much effort to be good. Jesus, man. I'm Gary Null, and we're going to go to some calls a little later, but we're going to take a break. And when we come back to the break, I promised you two, and they're not the whole version you can watch. And all of my notes from all the studies, all peer review studies, by the way, all from mainstream science, are on Gary Null footnotes. Plus, you can watch these videos by going to prn.fm, scrolling down, you'll see them. So when we come back, you're going to see from two mainstream orthodox physicians who probably have nothing in common with me, except they're leading the fight to save lives with COVID. They're on the front lines of saving lives for COVID, and they're both being attacked. Yet there's nothing in their background or their treatment modalities that deserve being attacked. So what does that say about the people attacking him? So we'll be back in a moment, and we're going from one to the next. Back in a moment.
It's turning into what all coronaviruses become over time. It's turning into a common cold for most people. If you have risk factors, look, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro good science. You know, your body, your choice. If you want to be a subject in an experiment and you think it's going to be a benefit to you, your body, your choice. Be fully informed of what the risks are. I don't think we need to be coercing people into a shot where one of the potential side effects is death. In order to keep your job, you have to get a shot for the which one of the side effects is death. Is that right? That's not moral. That's not ethical. The Delta variant, I call them scariants. They're 99.7 to 99.9% the same virus. And again, I'll go back to an earlier point. It's a benevolent mutation. It is acting more like a common cold. Why do we have runny nose as one of the symptoms now for this virus? Because it's acting slightly differently. It's weakening. It's not killing people at a higher rate. But those who've been vaccinated are getting Delta at a higher rate than those who have natural immunity. So viruses always mutate, and it's going to be among us for a long time, probably, as an endemic buzz level. So instead of thinking, okay, well, let's chase this variant, this scariant with a shot, I like to call them samients. It's the same virus. This isn't SARS-CoV-3 yet. And here's an immune problem. We form an antibody to this virus. An antibody is forever once you form it. If you have a good antibody, fantastic, great. Grandma still has immunity to measles from when she was a kid. But if you form a bad antibody and you do end up with SARS-CoV-3 two, three, 4 years from now, that antibody, and this is called immune priming, you're now primed with an antibody that down the road is your enemy, because now you're immune primed to hyperreact to the next variant of this virus, or this next basically speciation of the virus, the SARS-CoV-3. In the animal trials with SARS-CoV-1, we learned if you vaccinate the animals with a spike protein against SARS-CoV-1, they formed an antibody. Wonderful, great, look, an immune response. However, when they were exposed to wild-type virus down the road, a high percentage of those animals died very quickly. And in another percentage, in a mouse study, they had 100% lung inflammation of a particular type, eosinophil, a type of very inflammatory white blood cell in the lungs of those mice. So you may form an antibody and say, hooray, look, we're forming immunity within this population. But at the end of the day, when exposed to something different enough than what the vaccine was, you are damaging those individuals. We know those signals from SARS-CoV-1. We've seen this in cat coronavirus vaccines, where cats ended up with this horrible inflammation, swelling of the stomach, and about 30% of the cats died. So we know once you prime somebody with an antibody, and that antibody is good, great. But if you prime them with an antibody that is not good, sit back and pull out the popcorn, because we're going to be seeing something horrific happening immunologically to a population down the road. The honest answer is we don't know to what degree, but we do know the history of this, and history is one of the best teachers that we have. It's, let's look at the history of this family of viruses. This isn't influenza. This is not influenza. This isn't a common cold. This is a different family of viruses, and we know our success with other vaccines, with other viruses, that's fine. But this one, we have a very horrific track record with coronavirus vaccines and mammal trials, and there's a reason the FDA never let coronavirus SARS-CoV-1 vaccines come to the market, and never let MERS vaccines come to the market. Every time they saw the signals and they said, this is too dangerous for humanity. Well, this virus is 80% the same as SARS-CoV-1. Why would they not have that same mindset now? We know how horrifically SARS-CoV-1 and MERS vaccines failed. And now, without long-term safety data, we're pushing forward an investigational vaccine on a population without knowing those long-term signals.
Or safety rationale for ever vaccinating a COVID recovered patient. There's no rationale for ever testing a COVID recovered patient. My wife and I are COVID recovered. Why do we go through the testing outside? There's absolutely no rationale. I'd encourage this committee to actually look at what's being done and ask, is there any rationale? Is there any rationale for anything? Listen, there's plenty of COVID recovered patients. Let them forego the vaccine and let people who are clamoring for it get it. But at 80% herd immunity, in the vaccine trials, fewer than 1% in the vaccine and the placebo actually get COVID, fewer than 1%. The vaccine's going to have a 1% public health impact. That's what the data says. It's not going to save us. We're already 80% herd immune. If we're strategically targeted, we can actually close out the pandemic very well with the vaccine. But strategically targeted, people under 50 who fundamentally have no health risks, there's no scientific rationale for them to ever become vaccinated. There's no scientific rationale. One of the mistakes I heard today as a rationale for vaccination is asymptomatic spread, and I want you to be very clear about this. My opinion is there is a low degree, if any, of asymptomatic spread. Sick person gives it to sick person. The Chinese have published a study, British Medical Journal, 11 million people. They try to find asymptomatic spread. You can't find it. And that's been, you know, one of important pieces of misinformation. When Senator Hall called a conference call of what should we do in the Capitol when we reopened, I said, you know what? You know what we do at Baylor? You walk in and they zap your temperature. You got a temperature check and go in. Do we test everybody who walks into Baylor Hospital? No. Are they a lot sicker than everybody in this room? You better believe it. So why would we do something here at the Capitol that has absolutely positively no scientific rationale and then do it in this context? So my testimony as I sit here today is COVID-19 has always been a treatable illness. A very large study from McKinney, Texas, another one from New York City, show that when doctors treat patients early who are over age 50 with medical problems with a sequenced multi-drug approach with the available drugs, 4 to 6 drugs that are available to them, now the monoclonal antibodies are better, there's an 85% reduction in hospitalizations and death. 85%. 85%. I want you to remember that number. 85%. We have over 500,000 deaths in the United States. The preventable fraction could have been as high as 85% if our pandemic response would have been laser focused on the problem, the sick patient right in front of us. We're focused over here and focused over there and focused on masks and what have you. Laser focus, sick patient, treat them. We lost focus on the most fundamental thing. That's my testimony.
Yeah. Thank you. I can tell how passionate.
By the way, he is suggesting that it's not one drug. And this is true for all of the mainstream Orthodox doctors who are succeeding in saving lives. They're using combinations. And almost all the combinations include ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, but it depends upon the dosage. A prophylactic dose is different than a therapeutic dose. Plus the monoclonal antibodies, at least up for the first 10 days. After that, they're not using it. And plus there's other drugs. And we've given you a list of those drugs. So you have those. But they also include quercetin. He calls it quercetin. But it's quercetin, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc. And zinc is probably the most important of those. And also an antibiotic. Originally it was azithromycin, but there's different antibiotics that also work that will help with the bacterial part of the infection versus because it has no impact upon the viral. So, and also I've added in that we should be considering hyperbaric oxygen therapy if a person gets to that state. But none of these have been used in regular hospitals. And that's why tens of thousands of mainstream doctors and scientists signed the Great Burlington Declaration that they were challenging the orthodoxy. And yet, no one in mainstream media, no one at all, is challenging anything Fauci or the World Health Organization does. Even today, there's a whole campaign attacking ivermectin, and that is led by the AMA. And so when I read their report, it was laughably incomplete. I had the chairman of the board of the AMA write me a letter. And when I wrote the article about the corruption within the cancer establishment, which is just top to bottom corrupt, and I cited examples and individuals, names, etc. And so I wrote back and said, show me a single thing in my comments that is wrong, provable wrong, and I'll change it. Of course, he didn't, and he couldn't. So then I wrote a long letter to the chairman of the AMA and all of its directors, and I said, but you've been historically wrong. Have you apologized for the millions, literally millions of Americans, that's genocide, who died because of smoking, because you promoted smoking? You had this editor for over 23 years, a man named Fishbein, who went against Hoxie, who had a legitimate treatment, and Colley's toxins, who had a legitimate treatment, and Dr. Andrew Ivey and Krebiasin, who had a legitimate treatment, and he destroyed them and the advocates for it. I said, what about all those ads saying 47,000 doctors smoke Lucky Strikes or these doctors smoke Chesterfields? I said, think of all the people who believed you because you were representing doctors and they believed the doctors. Growing up in America, people trusted their doctors. So you have their deaths on your hands. Oh, and did you also forget that you had a secret department of investigations ran by a man named Throckmorton and another in Doyle Taylor in the basement of the AMA headquarters for 25 years, where their whole goal was to destroy all alternative therapy. And the alternative therapy they felt was most threatening were chiropractors because there are so many of them. So secretly they managed to stop all accreditation. They managed to stop all insurances. They stacked Lindsay, Mayor Lindsay, and Congressman Douglas, and Javits, a senator from New York, who was overseeing a committee, because they wanted to see, should chiropractic be covered by federal insurance? And 6 months before the first person testified, as I was able to prove, because I got the memos, they, everyone on the panel had been hand-selected and coached of what to say. So their final report, well, you know, an objective group of independent scientists says, no, it's not a real science. It is really a scientific cult, as the AMA has suggested. And that's why they couldn't get insurance. That's why they were dying. Literally, the whole profession would have been dead. But someone dropped a whole bunch of documents on my at my apartment, and that led to a whole series of articles. And they also, there's another one I'm going to give credit for. His name is Joe Lisa. Between the two of us, we stopped the AMA in its tracks and the 12 largest medical organizations, and they lost. And they had to acknowledge that chiropractic was a legitimate healing science, not an unscientific cult. That's what they called it. And hence chiropractic was able to survive. So is this the same group that secretly tried to destroy legitimate healing professions? And now you're going to lecture us on ivermectin? No, you're not going to lecture anybody, you fools. You're totally corrupt from top to bottom. And just for writing that damn article, I'm going to do another article on the AMA and bring the people up to track on what you've done and what you've supported that has led to deaths. And shouldn't you at least hold yourself in advance of looking at actual real science, or don't you have anyone working for the AMA that actually knows how to read a scientific article? Join some of Pacifica's ideologues. You're in perfect company. So yes, they are wrong. And yesterday I did a full investigative report and showed you over 240 studies on hydroxychloroquine and over 120 studies on ivermectin in on PubMed, and ask any of these thousands of medical doctors, are you saving lives using these in combination with other drugs? And the answer is yes. So when everybody in the establishment, when the New York Times and Washington Post and these other dancing fools over on MSNBC, when they all are against something and they're all using the same identical language, you know that they are the pit bulls sent out to attack anything that's legitimate. They're protecting profits, protecting Big Pharma, who pays their salaries. I ask for some callers to call in. I've only got a minute because we're going to go to our guest in a moment who's standing by. We have a guy, Kenny. Kenny, and we have two. I'll take those two. We got more. I can only take you two. Kenny, nice to have you on today. Tell us about, well, I'm going to ask you a quick question and you answer, all right? Were you diagnosed by a board-certified neurologist that you had multiple sclerosis?
I was.
Were you told that there was a cure or in treatment that could slow it down or stop it, or did they tell you that you would be going through a debilitation, maybe with some respites here and there, but in the end, you would have to prepare yourself for putting railings around your house and your bed, and that would be the end of it?
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, to be fair with the neurologist, when I asked him, I said, are there any vitamins or anything you could, you know, prescribe instead? And his fair answer was, well, I'm just not trained in that way.
Okay.
Answer.
After your wife and you came to the anti-brain aging study, and I remember we had to help you up the steps, and your wife was crying at the time. She said she can't get you up, and I said, not a problem. We can help him up. We can help him down. Do you have any multiple sclerosis today, and have you been deemed cured? And what did those same neurologists and even a separate group of neurologists say about your reversion of multiple sclerosis?
Gary, I'm currently 13 years MS-free. Self-empowerment is the key. And the neurologists are in disbelief, and the common statement or comment is, well, we guess you never had it to begin with, which never made sense to me.
Well, then why don't you sue them for malpractice for all the diagnosing and treatment and drugs they gave you? And this is the game they play with terminal cancer patients. You must never have the cancer. Then why were you treating me for the last year? And why was I in your hospital and dying in hospice care? You see, you can't have it both ways. This shows you the limitation of belief systems that don't allow any truth except their own. But you're free of multiple sclerosis. You're healthy. You reversed it. But for those of us who saw you where you couldn't walk, couldn't make it up steps, and it wasn't overnight. It took 16 months. Thank you. Did I say anything as inaccurate?
You didn't say anything inaccurate. And you know what? I've never taken a pharmaceutical, ever.
Good. Thank you, Kenny. We have Ron on the phone. Hi, Ron.
Hello. How you doing? Good to speak with you, Gary. Hope all is well.
Good. How long ago were you told that you were at the end stages of multiple sclerosis?
I have been told since I was originally diagnosed about 32 years ago that I had multiple sclerosis, and about 2 years ago I was told I have end stages of multiple sclerosis, and I said, I don't buy it, and I'm not playing part of this game with them.
After you were told that you had end stage or very advanced multiple sclerosis and you'd have to be limited to two crutches and walkers, did you come to the Center Park and ask to be trained for the marathon? And did you run, not walk, did you run the New York City Marathon with us?
Yes, I did. And I was in your, what we called at the time, the Gary's Running and Walking Club in Central Park. And we used to go out in the evenings and we used to do a lot of running around the park.
Yes. And even today, how long do they tell you that the normal lifespan is for a person with advanced multiple sclerosis?
You know, it's not a good prognosis according to conventional medical wisdom, so to speak. And I'm going to live to prove them wrong. And I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to get healthier and healthier. I was just in my backyard, weeding my backyard this morning. I live in a three-story brownstone and, you know, make it all around the house, no problems.
Good for you. We look forward to hearing from you again. Thank you, Ron.
I thank you so much, and God bless you for all that you do.
Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's standing by, Dr. Michael Hudson. He's well known in the field where there are a lot of economists out there. But his voice is different because he generally takes his time, thinks through issues, and then gives us a more unique perspective. He is one of our nation's finest, most important analysts. And he is also the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He is also a distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri. And he was the chief economic policy representative for Dennis Kucinich, who we had on recently, talking about his new efforts. Nice to have you back with us, Michael.
It's good to be back, Gary.
Michael, we're looking at a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. It hasn't passed the Senate yet, but probably will. We're told that this is going to help rebuild America. And based upon the history of promises of what they're going to do with the money allocated and what actually ends up happening to that money, I have some severe questions. I question them. Would you give us your perspective about what is likely to be the outcome of a infrastructure bill, and why won't it go to what it's supposed to be allocated for, to rebuilding the infrastructure that we desperately need? Look at New York City today. Look at California. Look at all the places that are burning and destroying infrastructure. Your thoughts, well, please.
No question that the country needs infrastructure, but ever since the 19th century, the promise of what to do infrastructure has always been followed by enormous corruption. It began with the railroads. Most of the great American fortunes in America were made by privatizing the railroads and just ending up giving the railroads vast land grants. And then when the railroads didn't spend enough to meet their promises, the government ended up paying all the money for it. So most infrastructure programs have ended up as giveaways to the vested interests, and it looks like ever since Donald Trump began talking about infrastructure, which is obviously America needs, the main contributors to the Democratic Party, who control the Democratic National Committee, said, let's make sure that if there is an infrastructure bill, it's done in a way that benefits our contributors. It has to benefit Wall Street and the major monopolies in a public-private partnership, meaning that the $3.5 trillion isn't going to be spent by the government on building infrastructure to provide its services at a low price, which is what other countries do, just as in the case of medical care, to lower the price of service. The $3.5 trillion seems to be done in such a way as it will be earmarked to be given to private interests, very much like the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, for cost-plus arrangements in a giveaway. Now, it's very unlikely that the Democratic congressman will actually go along with this. So I think at the very beginning of the Democratic administration, the Democrats said, let's talk about all the good things that could happen with public-private infrastructure, but let's make sure that it's the Republicans that do it. And the Democrat National Committee has made sure that in the elections, basically these are Republicans running as Democrats. They're Wall Street people running as Democrats and monopolists running as Democrats. So they have used the money for the campaign financing to finance Republicans running as Democrats, such as Joe Manchin is in West Virginia, or Christine Sinema in Arizona. And they've said, we're centrists and bipartisan. And by bipartisan, they mean we as Democrats will not vote for any bill that the Republicans do not support. So another, you have a substantial portion of the Democratic Party saying we will only vote for bills that attract Republicans. Well, why on earth do they run as Democrats then? Well, the answer is when they say they're a centrist and bipartisan, they mean we're really Republicans running on the Democratic ticket to make sure that a progressive candidate such as AOC in New York or Bernie Sanders or the others is crowded out and doesn't have any voice at all to say in the privatization program. So I worry that what we're seeing is a kind of kabuki theater, a kind of charade to pretend to do the $3.6 billion in a way that is going to be a travesty.
When you look at other industries like the military-industrial complex or big agriculture or big energy or big food and also big finance, these private-public partnerships I don't see ever benefiting the average person or small businesses or making society safer. I just don't see it. I see instead corporations realizing their political affiliations and political donations have gotten them a lot of money in return. Could you address that we don't stop and look at the outcome of these promises versus what we're promised if these things pass?
Well, you can see the outcome in the way they're structured to begin with. When people think of infrastructure, the Democrats keep talking about the successful versions like the Tennessee Valley Authority that built the dam and all of the New Deal government-sponsored activities at the beginning. And way in the 19th century, the original business program was, well, the government's job is to provide basic infrastructure like health care to provide tried to lower the cost of living so that corporate employers won't have to pay labor so much because the government's going to be providing their basic needs. But that's not the policy of the of today's Democratic or Republican Party. When they say public-private partnership, they mean the government will give money to the private sector on its own terms to be able to make a profit, to charge an interest, to take stock options, and to charge basically monopoly rents. And that means that the price of these infrastructure services are going to be so much higher than if the government provided them directly. So if the $3.5 trillion goes through, instead of lowering the cost of living by providing, renovating the bridges, renovating the highways, there's going to be a cost-plus type privatized contract that is going to increase the cost of everything. You're going to have roads turned into toll roads. You're going to have increased transportation that's going to benefit landlords and land values all along the path of transportation without any attempt to tax back the increase in land values and how real estate prices that this creates. So the government is going to be spending money for the beneficiaries of its campaign contributors, mainly the 1%, not the actual voters. So my worry is that despite President Biden's good instincts in wanting to build infrastructure, the Democratic National Committee and the actual people who are backing the right-wing candidates are going to make sure that the Democrats are going to say, no, we can't really go along with this. We're going to have to do it the way Donald Trump would have done. We have to do it with ripoffs for our campaign contributors.
When we look at what's happening now in Louisiana, and especially down New Orleans, where more than 1 million of the citizens are without electricity. Now, if you've been down to New Orleans, you know it's hot, it's sticky, it's very humid. If you don't have electricity, then you don't have water, and you don't have refrigeration. And so there's going to be a lot of privations. Now they're bringing in some generators. If you remember with Hurricane Sandy in New York, they had millions of gallons of water, but they weren't here. They had big, gigantic generators, but they weren't here. Nothing is ever where it's supposed to be, and yet an infrastructure should take into consideration what if, plan on the worst case, because often that's what we see, and then have those generators, have a one large facility per city in the United States that's vulnerable. So you have a place where people can at least have some sustainable life in the midst of a crisis. I don't see any of that happening when it comes to money being allocated for an infrastructure. I see it all going into the pockets of the major politicians or corporations that are influenced by the politicians. Your thoughts, please.
Well, when you see something not happening that should be happening, there's always a reason for it. The last big electrical blackout was in Texas, you remember, when there was a storm there. And the Texas rates went way, way up and left many families bankrupted who had signed special agreements to get priority in electricity for air conditioning or for other things, thousands of dollars for fees. So it looks like the ideal from Wall Street would be a Texas-type arrangement where they get there will be infrastructure and it will be able to profiteer with enormous fees for desperate situations. The ideal of controlling infrastructure is for the owner to say, your money or your life. And governments don't say that. Governments say, we're not going to charge you. There's a public right to electricity, a public right to health, a public right to education. But if you privatize it, it's no longer a public right. It's a profit opportunity to extract what economists call economic rent. That is a free lunch, money that doesn't have any cost of production. And with a public-private partnership, the government is going to provide the free lunch to the privatizers. So what's really at issue in all this is who's going to get the money for the infrastructure? Will it be the people as a result of government spending, or will it be privatized? And if it's going to be privatized, you're going to have the United United States looking like England looked under Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, and it'll go. It'll become a very high-cost, polarized economy.
Michael, hold your thoughts. We want to say goodbye to our WBA audience who's going to listen to the news. We're going to continue on PRN.FM. Let us use a recent example, Afghanistan. Estimates are between $2 to $3.2 trillion spent there. If you remember, a lot of it was supposed to be for infrastructure, rebuilding the country. When you go around the country now, you don't see that money. You see big military bases. You see phantom soldiers, and meaning soldiers that didn't exist in reality, but paychecks going to them that went to the people, the generals who were saying that we have, you know, 500 extra people here, so pay us their $500 or 500 salaries. Everywhere we look, our infrastructures are not based upon helping local communities thrive. I don't care where you go in the world. If you go to Venezuela, Cuba, any of the places we've tried to put sanctions on, you do not see where anything that could have actually helped the average person who gains nothing from sanctions but is suffering. And yet, the average American is unaware of how our money is spent, where money goes to. It's clueless. And yet, in all these bills, we hear this: you'll know what's in the bill once we pass it. Then we can read it. You mean you're going to pass a big piece of legislation and you don't even know what's in it? Well, we'll find out. That's no way to run a government. And yet that's what where trillions of dollars over the decades have gone into corporate and then pockets. And then I see today an article of how much money is spent each day in lobbying for different causes in Washington. And they virtually have captured the entire executive process there, the legislative, judicial, everything is impacted by donors. So where does the average person see anything actually benefiting them when everywhere in America you see infrastructure destroyed, rotted, broken down, inner cities rotted to the core, ghettoized, and that wasn't by the people living there. That was by corporate America finding it was easier moving their products and services over outside the United States to a cheaper place where labor was inexpensive. So why should we believe that this will be any less of a boondoggle than all the other promises that were broken in the past?
Well, that's the point. The Democrats actually think that they will benefit from what you've just described. They say once it turns out that the good infrastructure spending is overruled by right-wing Democrats, meaning Republican Democrats, and Republicans, the Democrats will go to the people in next year's election and saying, well, we couldn't give you the bill that we know you wanted because we didn't have enough Democrats to vote for it. You'll have to vote for yet more Democrats. And while they're saying this, hoping to get yet more advantage, right now you have the Democrats controlling the presidency, the Senate, and the House, nominally, but not in reality because so many Democrats are Republicans working, making deals with the people who fund their campaigns, which are the same people that fund the national committees of the Republican and Democratic parties. Again, Wall Street, the monopolists, the oil industry, the profiteers. So you mentioned Afghanistan and the $2 trillion that was spent there. Most Americans hear of $2 trillion spent in Afghanistan. They think this was spent on the Afghan people. But the $2 trillion was turned over, most of it was turned over to the military-industrial complex to provide weapons, which were just left there. Rest of the $2 trillion was paid to American forces there, mercenary forces. It was paid to American construction companies, and it just disappeared. So the money never ended up actually being paid to Afghanistan, except for the bribery money that was paid to local leaders. It was all paid to American companies, and Afghanistan was only an opportunity for the government to give money to these American companies, the military industrial, the big infrastructure builders that didn't build infrastructure, and the worry, of course, is that what happened in Afghanistan is just what's going to happen in the United States with its infrastructure program. A lot of money paid to companies. They're going to make a contract, and then there will be a surprising cost overrun that the media will say nobody expected the cost overrun when they all expect this to happen to begin with, and nobody expected that they wouldn't achieve the good standards that government spending would have done and that the government did with the TVA and the 1930s type infrastructure. And so they're all being set up for a failure that the Democrats are then going to try to use, well, you didn't give us enough votes, as if while the Democratic National Committee is making sure that in next year's elections, they throw all of the campaign money behind the centrist delegates, the bipartisan delegates, not the progressive delegates that really should be in charge of designing the infrastructure program, the Bernie Sanders, AOC, that whole group.
I appreciate your insight. We don't have time today. I'd like to invite you back to discuss just how much debt we have in the United States at all levels and compare that to our income, about $22 trillion, which makes us the world's leading in debtor nation, that we can never get out of this. And yet all the media is talking about how prosperous we are and Wall Street equities market going up, up, up. So we'd like to come back and discuss debt in America.
Sure. It takes longer time to discuss that than just 15 minutes. So
we'll set aside an hour. Professor Michael Hudson, and you can reach him. His website is michael-hudson.com. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.